If you spend time at the beach, you get used to seeing kelp washed up in the surf. There's always an assumption that there's plenty more where that came from, tall stalks of kelp growing offshore just under the surface. But this is a bad time for kelp in the Pacific in both of our states, and since kelp is part of a whole interconnected ecosystem, its absence affects many other animals and processes. So let's hear about the perfect storm of conditions that has decimated kelp and how the situation is being monitored and addressed. Two guests join us, one from each of the state fish and wildlife departments. Cynthia Catton's a biologist with California Fish and Wildlife Marine Region. Hi, Cynthia.
Hello.
Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Scott Groth joins us as well. He's with the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Marine Resources Program based in Charleston. Hi, Scott.
Hello, Jeffrey.
Good to have you here. Cynthia, let's start with you. This is several years in the making and involves several creatures. How did it all start?
Yeah, we saw a series of events occur on our coast starting in basically 2014, where it hit both Oregon and California, where we had a huge increase in the temperature that was sustained for multiple years, and also an influx of purple urchins that are devastating grazers on the kelp forest. And part of that might have come from the loss of our sea stars, actually, in 2013 in California, which happened in 2014 in Oregon. So there's a series of kind of interconnected, complicated events that have been playing out, and the results of that is that we've had like less than 10% of what we would normally have for kelp off of our coastline since 2014, and so that's coming up on 4 years now, and that's created some severe starvation conditions for a lot of the herbivores like abalone and all those urchins, actually.
So instead of kelp forests, you've got a whole other kind of ecosystem. What is that called?
Yeah, so we call those purple urchin barrens because they are just a whole rocky reef full of spiky purple urchins, and really nothing else can grow there when those urchins have taken over.
All right, we'll come back and talk more about the purple urchins in a moment, but urchin barrens instead of kelp forests, it's a very different kind of system, and if you look at the pictures online, it's fairly dramatic looking. Scott Groth, is the situation any better in Oregon, where the water is presumably at least a little bit colder?
I'll just leave the house. I wonder if you permit me to offer my...
Yeah, it's similar in Oregon. We have a little bit different nearshore than California does, but in our big offshore reefs that would normally hold most of the state's kelp, we have seen very little kelp production, and as a result, it's just been most of the kelp we've had has been up on the beach. The kelp on those offshore reefs hasn't been enough to supply herbivores like red sea urchins that depend on eating those for that drives the fishery for red sea urchins. So those fisheries have been sort of had to make some changes this year, mm-hmm. and look around for urchins that are around kelp beds. But our main offshore reefs have been severely depleted, as in California. And we've added purple urchins to those reefs as they, as Cynthia pointed out, has happened in California.
Well, Cynthia was also talking about sea stars and how that the problems that they had a couple of years ago, where they're basically just turning to goo in the ocean, is part of this picture. What's the story with them in Oregon waters at the moment?
Very similar. A lot of people have pointed out, some small rebounds of the Pisaster acratius, the purple and orange guys you see right at the tide line. You know, we have seen a little rebound of those populations. But the big difference that we've seen in Oregon is that the large, soft-bodied, predatory sea stars that people maybe are less familiar with seeing because they're a little deeper, but they really drive those subtidal nearshore areas. The main example is Pycnopodia, or a sunflower star that you can see at a low tide sometimes. Those have essentially disappeared from Oregon's nearshore, so that is probably a main driver in what brings purple urchins out and less worried to be walking around. So that's very similar in Oregon and California, I imagine.
Wow, okay. I didn't realize the sea stars were still taking that long to come back. We're talking about sea stars as part of a much larger picture involving giant kelp disappearing, mostly along the coast in Oregon and California, as you heard. Less than 10% in California water. Cynthia Catton is a biologist with California Fish and Wildlife. Scott Groth is with Oregon Fish and Wildlife. You can join the conversation with your questions and comments at 800-838-3760 by phone around the region. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So, Cynthia, this has shut down some fisheries in California, correct?
Well, it has really hurt the red urchin fishery up in Northern California, just as Scott was mentioning for Oregon as well, because the urchins, the part of the urchins that we are targeting for market is the uni, which is the gonad of the urchin. And when they are starving, then they're not producing, they're not becoming reproductive, and so they're not producing uni. So there are plenty of urchins out there. They're just not worth taking out of the ocean right now for market. The other fishery that has been impacted in Northern California so far is our recreational red abalone fishery, which we've been growing increasingly concerned about for the last few years, and we've been seeing increasing severity of symptoms of starvation in the abalone population, and this year we saw a lot of mortality, which led the Fish and Game Commission to enact a closure on the fishery for this coming season.
All right, and Scott, you mentioned our red urchin fishery closed in Oregon. Any others on the Oregon side?
So the red sea urchin fishery has just been a little slowed down this year. They're still actually quite active, but the red abalone fishery is a sport fishery in Oregon as well. It's about 1/100 the size of what California's very robust sport red abalone fishery is. But we have also suspended that, and for a lot of the same reasons that Cynthia has mentioned. Being at the northern end of their distribution, there's sort of naturally low densities of red abalones up here, but we have also seen evidence of starvation by abalones, particularly deeper individuals.
All right, so just not looking good. Any place where the fish or the creatures live around kelp, it sounds like.
I think that's true for Oregon, for sure.
Mm-hmm. So, Cynthia, when there's just so many broken parts here. When you have the urchin barren develops, how hard is it for kelp to reestablish in that landscape, that waterscape?
Yeah, so we have seen purple urchin barrens appear in the past, and we've tried various methods of either, turning that around or sometimes we just let them be. I think that our experience with them tells us that they are quite persistent, that the purple urchins rarely actually starve to death. You know, they are able to make use of other feed in the area and outcompete a lot of other creatures for the food that's available. So once they're established, they're hard to get rid of. But one thing that is really particularly concerning to us right now is the scale of the urchin barrens that we're seeing. Normally, we would see an urchin barren, a very large one, might be a mile of coastline. That would be pretty darn big.
That's a big one, okay.
And what we're seeing in Northern California, and Scott can speak to what's happening in Oregon, is over 100 miles.
Wow.
Of urchin barren.
100 times what you had before. And Scott, what are you seeing on the Oregon side?
So we've seen a little different things in Oregon, where the very close near shore where abalones live, there hasn't been as many purple urchins. But our offshore reef, in particular, we have one very large offshore reef in Oregon that supplies 50% of the kelp and 50% of the urchin harvest, as very large area, that went from having essentially no urchins on it. We've been sampling and studying that reef for 30 or 40 years, and it's never had any purple urchins on it, to having densities that are just through the roof this year. They arrived last year, I suppose, but a big change in that very big and important area. But then we have some of these other areas that seem to be avoiding it, right next to the beach. Hmm. So,
yeah, I will point
out
that in California, there is a very narrow band of algal growth, of seaweed that grows in the intertidal still, and down to maybe 5 feet deep. But if you are able to dive down deeper than that, you will see this extensive urchin barren, and it goes all the way up the coast.
Well, that is amazing. We were talking about kelp and the lack of it in the ocean, less than 10% of what is usually there on the California side, not a lot better on the Oregon side. Cynthia Cattins with California Fish and Wildlife, Scott Groth with Oregon Fish and Wildlife. Cynthia, this has happened elsewhere in the world. Tell us about Australia's experience, for example.
So the Australian experience, Western Australia, has had a huge... It was one of the first ones, I think, that really kind of brought this to the forefront in terms of the impacts of a marine heat wave that can have on the kelp forest. And they ended up closing much of their abalone fisheries in the northwest area of Australia. You know, it just creates this domino effect, and it's very challenging for the kelp to come back sometimes. So we've seen this this marine heat wave event happen on our coast. Like I said, it hit California in 2014. It was actually a mass of warm water that started in Alaska, which is an odd place mm-hmm. for us to start to get warm water from.
Truly.
You know, this was a really unpredicted and unprecedented event, and it was persisting for multiple years. And in 2015, it interacted with the El Nino condition that we had, which brought warm water up from the south as well. And I think we're kind of in the middle of you know, this confluence of multiple directions of warm water. So we had some really severe warm water events for a couple of years in particular. And warm water is stressful. Just like if I go out to the desert, I don't do very well. But, it also usually brings low nutrients, and so it's kind of a double whammy on the kelp and limiting their growth for those years.
Scott Groth, I have seen some people describe kelp forests as the rainforests of the sea. Are they that abundant for the creatures that live in them?
Yeah, for sure. It's the places you want to dive if you want to see, you know, all the action in the near shore. It's the most diverse and colorful and interesting places that we really have access to as humans. And like Cynthia said, we still have those in a strip of land really close to the beach, and that's affected a little bit of the human interpretation of what's going on in the kelp, not seeing beyond that as often. But mm-hmm. but yeah, those kelp forests are just beautiful places to see, and highly productive, as Cynthia points out.
We have a question here from listener Kate, don't know which town from. She's asking if there's any connection to Fukushima and the killing of kelp and other sea life, the 2011 earthquake in Japan, and the leaking of the nuclear power plant at Fukushima. Cynthia, any connection there?
Yeah, that's a great question, and one that comes up a lot. There's, whenever we have really big, devastating events, then, we want to see if they are connected. Fukushima occurred in 2011, and after that point, we were very concerned about seeing radioactive materials coming over to our coastline, and I think you probably saw, there was quite a lot of debris that washed up on shores. But in terms of the, how much radioactivity was in the water itself that reached us, we were working with a group out of Lawrence Livermore on a project called Kelp Watch, and if you Google that, I think you can come up with it.
Kelp Watch, okay.
And they set up a whole series of sampling locations up and down our coast and in Hawaii and Guam and all the way up into Alaska and down into Baja. So they covered a lot of area, and they were working on, we were pulling samples of kelp because we can, because the kelp will concentrate that those molecules in them.
Mm-hmm.
And so that makes it easier for us to detect at small levels in the water. So we were participating in that, and we never were able to detect the in particular they were looking for cesium. So I don't think that they were related events. There seems to be potentially a virus that was impacting the sea stars, but we're still, that's continued area of study.
All right, so for not can't be sure of any effects from radiation.
Right.
Just a couple seconds left here, Cynthia. I mean, are there efforts to reestablish kelp forests? Is there active management of those?
So I'm developing a partnership with academics and other government agencies and nonprofits and community groups. We're working to build solutions to this moving forward and thinking about how we can help the kelp to recover. We, like I said, the scale of this is a bit overwhelming, and it's something that we probably can't knock back without Mother Nature's help, but maybe we can help Mother Nature bring this back faster.
Okay, a little assistance on both sides. All right,
yeah.
Some fairly shocking numbers here. Less than 10% of the usual kelp, plus the usual one-mile urchin barrens, now 100 miles on the California side. Cynthia Katna, biologist with California Fish and Wildlife Marine Region. Scott Groth with Oregon Fish and Wildlife Marine Resources Program. Thank you both for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you.